Good morning, everyone. We're going to get started on the Senate Committee on Judiciary. We have a public hearing with a possible work session. We're not going to be able to do a work session on that. That's on Senate Bill 310. And then we have a number of work sessions, and it appears that we have all the documentation we need except for one of those. So I'm going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 310. And Andrew Meyer is going to come forward, and we need to, I guess, get the other person that's going to be joining us by telephone, Ms. Brown, onto the lines, and she is not going to be here in person.
Well, she could listen to what I'm saying so she's not repetitive and only answering questions.
You'd like me to dial
yes,
now?
Yes, please.
Oh, sure.
Meyer team. Meyer team.
The M&Ms. M Square. Sorry.
I'm the blue today.
Rebecca Brown, this is Bill.
Ms. Brown, this is Floyd Przonski. How are you doing today?
Good. How are you?
Fine. We're going to see if we get you up on volume so you can hear us and we can hear you. We've just opened up our public hearing on Senate Bill 310. Andrew Meyer is going to give us testimony. We thought it might be convenient as well as efficient for you to be hearing what she says so we won't have redundancy.
Sure.
So with that, Andrea, if you'd like to give us your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director of the ACLU of Oregon, and I'm pleased today to speak on behalf of Senate Bill 310. You have written testimony for me and Ms. Brown. I'm not going to read it, but I do want to talk about how the powerful use of DNA in the criminal justice system has expanded over the years, both to investigate, to prosecute the guilty, and exonerate the innocent. I don't know how many of you saw the 60-minute story this weekend. It was a powerful story of Ronald Cotton and Jennifer Thompson. In 1984, Ms. Thompson was raped. And during that rape, she decided that the most important thing beyond survival was to memorize the face of the man raping her so she could bring him to justice. And she did that. Mr. Cotton was arrested. She picked him out of a photo lineup. She picked him out of a real person lineup. He was then convicted of rape. He went to prison, where he saw another man who looked very similar to him. And of course, it need not go without saying that Mr. Cotton, throughout this, maintained that he was innocent of this crime. He saw a man that looked very similar to him. In fact, people mixed up their names. And this man was said to have indicated to other people that he committed that crime. Mr. Cotton was successful in getting another trial. And yet Ms. Thompson sat there again, and without a doubt in her mind, identified Mr. Cotton, not the person who was truly guilty who was sitting there. He then went back to jail a second time. But fortunately, there was an evidence box, and they were able to take out the rape kit, the swab, and there was one sperm, and they were able to test it 11 years later, and Mr. Cotton was exonerated. But for the retention and preservation of that evidence today, he would still be in jail. I think that one of the most moving parts of the story, as you can imagine, Ms. Thompson was devastated, because she had been a victim of a terrible crime and in turn had put away a man who was also innocent. And they speak together today because there are issues obviously about witness identification, which this isn't the issue of today, but it was a very powerful story. And DNA testing saved him. In Oregon, we've been involved in terms of DNA for use of exoneration back in 2001 when ACLU, OCDLA, the DAs, and the chiefs of police joined together in supporting Senate Bill 667, which was a post-conviction motion for DNA testing law that's now codified in ORS 138690 through 698. That allows for someone who has gone through all the post-conviction relief and to seek a motion before the court for DNA testing of evidence that was in custody at the original investigation. That law has many safeguards. I'm not going to go into extensive detail, but it has safeguards to avoid abuse, and the defendant must make a motion and the court must review it to assure that it is not for purposes other than to get testing to prove innocence. And one of the things, though, that is required under that law, of course, is that the evidence be preserved so it can be tested. And we are here today to address that piece of the important work that we as a state are doing on DNA, and both for conviction and for exoneration. DNA technology is rapidly moving forward. It was originally intended, I think, by many people for folks who didn't have access to DNA testing at all when they were convicted, but now we find that it protects people who did have DNA testing available either because the DNA evidence was not sufficient enough, or in some jurisdictions, and fortunately not in the state of Oregon, where there's been mishandling or improper testing. We need to have laws that take into account the changes not just today, but 5, 10, 20 years from now with the technology of DNA. I think as Ms. Brown will testify, I believe it's now over 232 innocent people have been exonerated, some sitting on death row. And the use and the power of DNA to exonerate is very powerful, but it's very limited in what circumstances someone can actually show their innocence. Senate Bill 310 takes us to the next step of preservation policies in the criminal justice system, modernizing the evidence preservation practices. There will be some amendments that I will talk with you about the bill. There should be the dash ones. But let me first say that it is in 2004, Congress passed the Justice for All Act, codified 18 U.S.C. 3600A, and in fact, they've got federal preservation for federal crimes. They've detailed their regulations, and they actually have some federal grants that Oregon might be eligible for if we move forward. More than a dozen states have these safeguards in place, and they allow, of course, for safeguards to prevent the innocent from being incarcerated and sometimes to substantiate guilt. Storage has been, I think, articulated as the biggest issue and the biggest concern around both evidence and potentially this legislation. I believe this legislation helps address, not exacerbate, growing issues around limited storage. This establishes clear policies and practices for preservation, as well as clear policies and practices for destruction of evidence. The policy will reduce the guessing game by government across the state by giving a rational policy, prioritizing appropriate and limited preservation and destruction consistent with DNA technology. I want to talk about the specifics of the bill. The preservation is only, again, of biological evidence secured in the course of the original investigation. We are willing to limit the scope of crimes to which preservation will be required to murders and sex crimes, but the broader the coverage, the better the policies and practices we put in place to take into account long-term needs. Biological evidence is defined in the bill, similar to federal law, and it's blood, semen, hair, saliva, skin tissue, fingernail scrapings, bone, body fluids, and other identified biological evidence. The preservation period would be the period of incarceration, and with sex crimes no longer than required to report after release, and for murder when the person dies. That's similar to the DNA innocence law that we have because of the penalties that continue with those individuals even after release. Destruction of evidence is allowed under this law. A custodian may destroy prior to a period, any period of the requirement under the law, if notice is sent to the defendant, defense counsel, DA, and the state. And the parties have 180 days to respond to either request testing at that time or retention, and if they don't, destruction is allowed. And this is, again, similar to federal law already in place. There are additional safeguards. Sections 1, sub 5, does not require the preservation of evidence if it is of such size, bulk, or physical characteristics to render retention impracticable. That's a very loose standard and I think makes it possible for everyone to move forward successfully with this. The custodian, therefore, needs only to remove and preserve portions likely to contain DNA evidence in a quantity sufficient to permit future testing. Again, federal law has dealt with this and has clear guidance, so this is not a new issue. If preservation is required under this law and the custodian is unable to produce it in judicial proceeding, they must sign an affidavit showing why it cannot be located and the effort taken to locate. The penalty under this law is it's up to the court to sanction. It does not give the defendant new rights or new remedies. Interestingly enough, we did not mirror federal law on this, which allows for a civil penalty against the entity or the persons who do not preserve and up to 5 years in jail for failure to properly preserve under the federal law. We have some proposed amendments that are reflected in Dash 1. First of all, we are removing on page 2, lines 31 through 35, we're removing lines 33 through 35 that broadly define custodian to include hospitals. We want to limit it to consistent to the practices in Oregon. We are removing the task force set forth in Section 2, which are pages 2 through 4. Instead, we're giving authority to the Oregon DOJ to develop the standards for proper collection, retention, and cataloging biological evidence under the law. Number 3, and I'm not sure if it's contained in this amendment, but the Forensic Service Division of the Oregon State Police requested that we specifically state that the biological evidence to be retained is human DNA, so as not to create any unintended consequences for the Oregon State Police Fish and Wildlife Division. We are happy to make sure it does not include fish or birds. As I already mentioned, we are willing to limit the scope of crimes, but urge a broad consideration. We appreciate the opportunity for this important chapter to take place in the course of our discussions about DNA preservation and the powerful use of DNA in Oregon, and we request this committee to, when the amendments are finalized, please move forward and pass Senate Bill 310. Thank you. I'm happy to answer any questions, or if you just prefer to go to Ms. Brown, who can...
Let's go ahead and get Ms. Brown's testimony, and then we can open it up. Gail Meyer may also want to give testimony. Ms. Brown?
Thank you. My name is Rebecca Brown. I'm a policy analyst with the Innocence Project. And on behalf of the Innocence Project, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today, even if by telephone. The Innocence Project was founded in 1992 at the Benjamin Cardozo School of Law to exonerate the innocent through post-conviction DNA testing. Since its introduction, forensic DNA testing has proven the innocence of 233 people. Not one of these exonerations would have been possible without the proper retention of biological evidence, nor would the identification of many of the actual perpetrators of those crimes. To date, the real perpetrators have been identified among 100 of the 233 individuals exonerated, so that's 43% of our cases, the true perpetrators were also identified. As you know, poorly preserved, lost, or destroyed evidence can frustrate even the most aggressive efforts to solve cases, whether it be a cold case or one that seeks to exonerate someone who may have been wrongfully convicted. Our nation's evidence rooms have become crime-solving gold mines. Understandably, when legislation is considered, evidence custodians become concerned that they'll be expected to save evidence for which they believe they have no room. And as Ms. Meyer alluded to before, the federal government faced the same concern when they passed the Justice for All Act, which included provisions mandating the preservation of biological evidence associated with all criminal offenses. And in order to make that law practicable, the feds issued a set of regulations which spoke to concerns about the retention of large bulk items. It provided a set of case examples to help interpret the law. For instance, if a crime took place in a vehicle, the entire vehicle did not have to be preserved, but a cutting could be taken. And Oregon can look to the federal regulations for guidance. Indeed, this is a practicable reform. Passage of this bill would not require the immediate retention of additional evidence. It would only require evidence that's already in the state's possession to be held onto for safekeeping. And also, as Ms. Meyer mentioned, you know, if you narrow the crime category in this proposed bill, you will find that you're really just intelligently targeting that evidence which must be kept and sort of clearing room for that evidence moving forward by allowing for the destruction of evidence that is not necessary to keep moving forward. Practical considerations have to be balanced with the notion of preserving all evidence, but I think we can all agree that the retention of biological evidence that has the power to settle innocence claims and identify the true perpetrators of crime should be a primary law enforcement objective. Unfortunately, in state after state, we've been appalled to learn about evidence loss and destruction, Between 2004 and 2008, our office was forced to close just under 25% of our cases from around the country because evidence was lost or could not be located. So this is not just a problem in Oregon, it's a problem in every state. And it just should not continue. New forms of DNA analysis make it possible to test evidence that even just a few years ago could not have yielded probative results. Mini-filer amplification and mitochondrial testing, among the recent DNA testing advances, have made it possible to learn more than ever before from limited or degraded evidence. Additionally, a mask or another piece of clothing found at a crime scene contains skin cells that have only recently been subjected to DNA testing with any regularity. Such testing has resulted in the exoneration of wrongfully convicted people in a number of cases, and it has led investigators to the true perpetrators of crime through CODIS hits, through the National DNA Database. I'm going to just share one very brief case example with you of Ricky Johnson. He was convicted in 1983 of aggravated rape. He was sentenced to life without parole in Louisiana. And his conviction was secured based upon the strength of conventional serological testing and an eyewitness identification made by the victim. With the case going to trial years before DNA tests were to become common law enforcement tools, no DNA tests were performed on the evidence. Throughout his ordeal, he maintained his innocence. He held out hope that the truth would be discovered. And in 2006, the Innocence Project took on his case, and the district attorney agreed to test swabs from the rape kit using conventional DNA testing. That was called SPR testing. The test produced just three markers, enough to exculpate Mr. Johnson, but not a sufficient number to help identify the perpetrator. Just a year later, a new form of DNA testing, mini-filer SPR, was performed. And that makes it possible to examine badly degraded evidence. And through the use of this new technology, eight additional markers were found, and it yielded a full profile. The identification of the true perpetrator was only made possible by the retention of the evidence attached to this crime, and that profile not only proved his innocence, thereby leading to Mr. Johnson's exoneration, but it also enabled the evidence to be run through the National DNA Database, resulting in a hit to the true perpetrator, a man who is housed in the same prison as Mr. Johnson. His case shows the promise that new technology holds for solving long-forgotten cases. It's a testament to the crime-solving potential of modern-day DNA technology. And I think it also should be mentioned that the loss and destruction of biological evidence really harms crime victims. In 2007, a Pulitzer-nominated Denver Post series shed light on the tragic consequences of evidence destruction and shared the perspectives not only of the potentially innocent, but also crime victims. One story focused on Susan Cash, a woman raped in 1985. After a multi-year odyssey in which she searched for the rape kit in her case, she was informed that the evidence had likely been destroyed. She was quoted in the series as saying, "I can't believe that. You keep your taxes longer than that." What I've been told is that they had a storage problem. It is just so infuriating. Safeguarding biological evidence is in the interest of all members of the criminal justice community, from crime victims to law enforcement to the wrongfully convicted. In a large portion of cases in which the innocent are exculpated, the guilty are also identified through CODIS hits. Many states have begun to realize that their retention policies fail to keep up with DNA's technological advances. And just last year, three states passed laws that mandated the preservation of biological evidence. So I thank you once again for your efforts to improve Oregon's evidence team. Please feel free to call upon us at any stage in your work, and we're very grateful to you for all you've done thus far. Your anticipated attention to this matter. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Brown. Gail, did you have some words that you want to share?
I do. Thank you. Thank you, Chair Prasowski, members of the committee. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I just want to underscore how much the science of DNA testing has changed the ballgame in criminal cases in the last 30 years. I think back to those cases I had where there was the eyewitness identification pointing at my client across the room saying, "This is the man that did it." And when your client is saying, "No, it wasn't me," it was probably the scariest moments in my career as a lawyer. Those cases, fortunately, in sex assaults don't happen anymore because now there is the prompt rape kit that's taken from the victim and the defendant. There is an exoneration or there's an implication. And I can tell you that they do result to pleas when your client is otherwise contesting that they've got the wrong person. So this is one of those bills that happily, I think, serves everybody's needs equally. This definitely protects the innocent, who might ultimately be falsely accused, at least initially. It protects the public because it absolutely nails the guilty. And it also protects the victims. Those victims of cold assault that have had to go through the invasion of a sexual assault kit that is then retained. If there's a cold case, a known suspect, we would ask and expect the custodians to hold on to that evidence and not destroy it prematurely until the ultimate assailant is found and identified. So I don't think there's any losers here. I think there's only winners. And the Oregon criminal defense lawyers would love to assist in any amendment process, but we definitely urge the committee to pass the bill.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. We'll open up for the panel for any questions or comments. Not seeing any. Y'all did a great job. Ms. Brown, thank you very much for joining us today. And we're going to go ahead and sign off at this time.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 310? Not seeing anyone. Thank you very much.
Okay. Sure. Well, hopefully we look forward to coming back with some amendments to move forward with this legislation, I hope.
Well, that's, we'll be looking at it. We're closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 310. As I said, there's no reason for us to move forward since we don't have the documentation anyway, plus there are some amendments I expect that will be occurring. With that, committee, I think we're now going to be, we will be moving into our work sessions. And just for everyone who was not here at the beginning, Senate Bill 87, which is the first one up, is not going to be able to move today because we don't have all the paperwork. So we're going to start our work sessions at the second one in, which is Senate Bill 89. And council.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 89, we adopted the Dash 2 amendments on February 23rd. The bill comes to you from the State Fire Marshal's Office, exempts persons possessing a permanent license issued by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives to possess, store, or manufacture explosives from the requirement to register with the State Fire Marshal. You have the Dash 2 amendments in front of you, Mr. Chairman, as a committee that have already been adopted. There are no other amendments. Those amendments simply clarify that if you comply with the United States Department of Transportation's procedures for license, you don't need to do anything else. Okay, right.
And there's no fiscal, I assume, Mr. Chair.
My understanding there is not.
Mr. Chair, I move SB 89 to the floor as amended.
All right, Senator Boquist moves Senate Bill 89 as amended by what was the Dash 2s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Ordered. Senator Boquist, will you be our carrier?
Sure, I will.
Be delighted.
And we'll close the work session for Senate Bill 89. We'll open a work session for Senate Bill 93.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 93 comes at the request of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. And as with the other bills, 93, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, this is listed wrong on the printed form. This actually comes from the State Court Administrator's Office. Allows the State Court Administrator to enter an agreement with the United States Financial Management Services and the Internal Revenue Service for the purpose of attaching federal income tax refunds. This could save. The state of Oregon could collect as much as $60 million of this bill, Mr. Chair.
60? Is it 6-0?
6-0, Mr. Chair. Members of the
Chair will take a motion for $60 million.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the federal law also has to change, and another, I think this committee also has a memorial to Congress that we just received asking to change federal law.
All right.
Mr. Chair, we don't get it yet, but I'll still move SB 93 to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist moves Senate Bill 93 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And Senator Dingfelder, if you'll be our carrier for this one.
For $60 million, I'd be happy to.
You bet. And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 93. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 238.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 238 comes to you at the request of the Oregon State Bar Estate Planning Section. And on February 23rd, we adopted the Dash 1 amendments. This bill enacts the Uniform Guardianship and Protected Proceedings Jurisdiction Act. The Dash 1 basically substitutes the term conservatorship for protective. We have all the paperwork on this, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and it's ready to go.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm assuming there's no revenue and no fiscal impact.
That's correct, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. What I do is when I first get the bill up, I put, I'm not sure, and then when after we vote, I then...
Counselor, I'm just putting it on the record.
Right.
Okay.
so nobody asked us. Okay. Mr. Chair, I move SB 238 to the floor with due pass.
Do we adopt as adopted with the
as adopted with the dash one?
Yeah. Senator Boquist moves Senate Bill 238 as adopted by the dash one amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So order, and Senator Bonamici, you'll be our carry on this one, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 238, and we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 314.
Chair, Committee, Senate Bill 314 comes to you at the request of through Senator Przanski, at the request of Tom Sywell.
Sywell,
excuse me, Mr. Chairman of this committee. There are no amendments. The bill requires the driver to report to law enforcement immediately an accident involving an injury or death.
Mr. Chair, again, for the record, there's no revenue, no fiscal statement. And Mr. Chair, I move SB 314 to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist moves Senate Bill 314 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair,
Senator Wissett.
I'll support this bill today. I'm not sure I'll support it on the floor. I need to do some more further study on it.
All right. And just for the discussion purpose, what Senator Boquist asked me off, off camera at some time back as to whether or not if a person just called 911 if that would be sufficient, and that is correct. What this is basically attempting to do is to have someone, when they're involved in an accident that meets a criteria for reporting, that they report it as quickly as possible to law enforcement so law enforcement can actually respond as needed. So any other comment or discussion? Any objection at this time? And with the reservation of Senator Wissett maybe changing his vote in the future, so ordered. And I'll be the carrier on this one. And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 314, and we'll open a work session on 356.
Chairman, Senate Bill 356 comes to you from the interim Senate Judiciary Committee. Clarifies Oregon's forfeiture laws and incorporates changes in laws to reflect current enactment of ballot measure 53, reenacts Oregon's forfeiture laws. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, on February 23rd, we adopted the dash one amendments.
All right.
Mr. Chair, I move SB 356 as amended to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist moves Senate Bill 356 as amended by the dash one amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered, and the chair will carry this one since I've done so much work on this area. And we'll close the work session for 356, open a work session on 373. Council.
Committee Senate Bill 373 comes to you from Senator Bonamici, makes an employer liable for an employee when the employer fails to pay a support enforcement division in a timely manner, wages being withheld as a result of support enforcement order. On February 23rd, we adopted the dash one amendments.
And Mr. Chair, for the record, again, there's no fiscal on this, correct? Mr. Chair, move SB 373 as amended to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist moves Senate Bill 373 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussions? Any objection? So ordered. And Senator Bonamici, you'll be our carrier on this one. I'll close the work session for Senate Bills 373 and open a work session for 404.
Chairman's Committee, Senate Bill 404 repeals ORS 2160 and 2170, all provisions that made an attorney liable for costs, other state attorney liable for costs associated with litigation in here, in this state. Provision that goes back to 1862. You have the dash two amendments in front of you. And they basically include contempt proceedings and ancillary proceedings arising out as an application of those two statutory provisions. The main difference between this and the dash ones that we saw the last time is they take effect upon passage. Maybe we just got the fiscal statement.
For the record, there's no fiscal and no on either the main bill or the dash two. In the meantime, Mr. Chair, I'll move the dash 2 into SB 404.
Senator Boquist moves the dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 404. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
And your review regarding revenue?
There's no revenue fiscal. Is there no fiscal?
No fiscal. The fiscals, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, are either no fiscals or minimal or indeterminate. Nothing that would require any of these bills to go to a Ways and Means Committee or Revenue Committee in any of them.
Great. Thank you, thank you, Councilor. Mr. Chair, I move SB 404 as amended by the -2 amendment to the floor with a do pass.
Senator Boquist moves Senate Bill 404 as amended by the -2 amendments to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So order. And Senator Wissett, would you be our carrier on this one? And we'll close the work session for SB 404 and open a work session for Senate Bill 313.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Senate Bill 313 comes to you from Senator Pozanski. Creates an evidentiary privilege for parents and children that would not force a parent to testify against his or her child. You have the -1 amendments in front of you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, which basically narrow the privilege somewhat. There was another set of amendments that people had talked to you about from the Juvenile Rights Project. They came to my office last night, and after discussion with Legislative Council's office, they decided not to go forward with those amendments. That's my understanding.
So what we need is the dash ones to be, adopted if we want to narrow it.
Mr. Chair, they apply if the communication is made out of the presence of all the persons except the child's sibling under the age of 18. Defines parents by reference to ORS 416-400, which would also include a step-parent paying child support.
All right.
Supporting the child, excuse me.
Mr. Chair, I move the -1 amendment into SB 313.
Senator Boquist moves the -1 into Senate Bill 313. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
And again, Mr. Chair, just for the record, there's no fiscal. And with that, I'll move SB 313 as amended with the -1 amendment to the floor with a two pass.
All right. Senator Boquist moves Senate Bill 313 as amended by the -1 amendments to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And again, the chair will carry this one. Council, what else do we need to do today?
Chair, members of the committee, I think we've done enough. We've all got our production bonuses today.
All righty. Thank you very much, and that will conclude our work for today. We're scheduled to be here tomorrow, I believe, at 8:30, and with that, we're adjourned. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.